Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
We are back. You're listening to America This Week. I'm Father Matt Malone. Our guest this week is Father Patrick Ryan, who is the Lawrence J. McGinley Professor of Religion and Society at Fordham University and an expert on Islam. And we've been talking about the caliphate, which the so-called Islamic State in the Middle East today claims to be the heir to. But one of the things that we were talking about during the break is how this really is contradicts the very history of Islam, doesn't it?
Whether the caliphate is really necessary to Islam at all has been sometimes questioned. There was a famous Egyptian scholar in the 20th century, in the early 20th century, who only died in 1966, Ali Abdul Razik, who simply said that the prophet came to be a prophet de facto. He galvanized the Arabs into one society, but he was not setting up a religious state. Mm-hmm. And he lost his license to teach for saying that.
Right.
But de facto, that's what had happened with the collapse of the caliphate, with the Mongol destruction of murder of the caliph, beheading of the caliph in 1258. There was no real caliphate after that. The Mamluk puppet caliphate was for display to foreigners who were visiting Egypt. And then the supposedly Selim the Grim, the famous Ottoman caliph who conquered Egypt in 1517, took the title of caliph to himself. It was until the 19th century that Abdul Hamid, the sultan of the Ottoman Empire at that time, decided that he was the caliph because he was competing with the Tsar of the Russias.
Right.
Just the Tsar was supposedly the protector of the Orthodox Christians in the Ottoman Empire. He said he was the protector of the Muslims in the Russian Empire.
So is there an analogy in another religious tradition, maybe our own, to what we are seeing now with this so-called Islamic State? From our own history, in which a group has taken a part of the history and distorted it and brought it into the present.
Well, I think we can look at some of our Puritan forebears, as we always say around Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. not your forebears or mine, but the Puritans certainly had the idea of setting up a state based on piety.
Right.
And a city on a hill and all the rest of it. And so that certainly survived for a while until basically the Massachusetts Bay Colony became unlivable.
Right.
And you have, as a result, Connecticut and
Rhode Island
and so forth and so on.
Right.
The Hutchinson River Parkway.
Roger Williams was the victim of the Christian Caliph in Boston.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah.
Right.
So there have been various attempts like that. I mean, certainly in the Middle Ages, there were some Holy Roman emperors who took their role very seriously, that they were to create a Christian state. I think Charles V probably was the one best known from early Jesuit history.
Yes.
But also Charlemagne himself, in many ways conscious precisely of the competition of the Muslim caliphate, which was still strong at his time in the 800s. So I think Charlemagne really saw himself as sort of a Christian caliph.
Right.
No, the Islamic State today has, you know, been all over the news. People are sort of learning about it gradually, I think, and it's made a lot of people, I think, view Islam itself as a violent religion. But I think a lot of the research and the studies have shown that there's actually a disconnect between Islam and this Islamic State today.
Mm-hmm. I've lived for 26 years in West Africa, in Nigeria and Ghana. And my first encounter with Islam was among the Yoruba people of southwestern Nigeria, who are very large ethnic family of about 30 million people. They're about half Christian, half Muslim, mm-hmm. sometimes in the same household, husband and wife. And
right.
The boys are Muslims, the girls are Christians, and so forth and so on, or a mixture. So I've learned that's the way I came to learn Islam at first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nigeria, another corner of Nigeria, the northeast, is being troubled by an extraordinarily militant and really crazed group. They don't call themselves Boko Haram. That's what the newspapers call them. It's, the Boko is simply the word book from right. English. Mm. Has come into Hausa, although Hausa has a proper word for book. But books are forbidden. In other words, Western education is forbidden. But that's not their only issue. they're trying to... they're in a part of Nigeria that's been very badly underdeveloped,
mm-hmm.
and all the wealth in Nigeria is concentrated in the petroleum industry in the southeast of the country, and that has led to a great deal of neglect and underdevelopment of many other parts of the country. But here is an area once known historically in the early 19th century for the rather tolerant regime of the Kanuri Muslims, who were different from the Fulani, but now has suddenly signed up. And it has connections across the Sahara, probably to what they call Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and to various groups who were terrorizing oil industry things in southern Algeria and things like that. So there's a lot of strange happenings going on. The fact that it's because of the media that I see now pictures of Ahmadou Shekau, the apparent head of Boko Haram, with an ISIS flag.
Right.
But I suppose you can have an ISIS flag made. I point out in that article, the black flag is always connected with the Abbasid revolution in the middle of the 8th century, 750, because they were supposedly mourning the members of the household of Muhammad who had been kept out of office by the Umayyads.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, that's the curious thing. Even though they were flying black flags in Fallujah in 10 years or so ago, and I remember Dexter Filkins in the Times saying it was the flag of piracy. Oh, come on, you've read too many comic books.
Right.
it's not piracy at all. It's the flag of the Abbasids.
Right.
The flag of the Umayyads was white.
Right.
The flag of the Prophet was green.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing that occurs to me is, you know, even if, I mean, one of the things that you point out in this article is that this their own self-understanding, the so-called Islamic State, is really at odds with their own history. Mm. But at the same time, they're having a certain degree of success. I mean, the amount of territory that they now occupy, their command of some of the natural resources and the industry,
yes.
and also they're doing the things that governments do. They're providing social services. They're reaching some of these people who have been disenfranchised and living in endemic poverty. And you know, so how is it that we are to counter this force?
Well, I think there's going to have to be some reconsideration of the decisions made between Versailles and San Remo in the end of the First World War.
Right.
And the divisions of the Middle East, whenever you see those straight lines that separate Syria and Iraq.
Those square states or straight lines.
Those were done by Churchill with a ruler in 1921 in Cairo. He said, I created Transjordan one afternoon in Cairo in May of 1921.
Right.
And that type of
And he
of
may
thing,
not have been sober.
that's another issue entirely.
Right.
The fact is that it does seem that the French and the British, I mean, we know about the Sykes-Picot Treaty,
mm-hmm.
Which is glossed over pretty much in the movie Lawrence of Arabia. I think the figure called Dryden is supposed to represent both the Sykes and Picot in some sense. But and the full story of Lawrence, I don't think we'll ever know exactly what side he was on. I think
right.
he may have changed sides. But the fact is that the Arabs, and especially the Sharif of Mecca and his two sons, Faisal and Abdullah, were promised they would rule the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were left with Arabia, which at that time didn't seem to be much because nobody knew how much petroleum was under the sands, except for Kuwait. And then they were thrown out of Arabia. So they landed up basically after the Saud family conquered the whole of Arabia
mm-hmm.
By the mid-20s. They landed up becoming Faisal. The French wouldn't have him in Syria. he wanted to be king from Damascus, so he was sent to Baghdad. Here's a kingdom for you.
Right.
And his third or fourth successor was assassinated in 58.
So you think we need to reassess yeah. these national boundaries?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that all the divisions of the Middle East at that time, the Ottomans were not such a bad idea, just as the Austro-Hungarians were not such a bad idea.
Right.
Because the fact is you have all these problems in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. Where is Hungary? Where is Romania? Ethnic Hungarians in Romania and so forth and so on. And then Sudetenland, all those things with the Czech Republic is now separated from Slovakian Republic. But they were created and they were uncreated. The same thing with Yugoslavia,
right.
Created and uncreated. Those are post-World War I solutions which didn't work
right.
in the long run. And
it was the Western powers imposing
yes,
these boundaries
exactly,
and
yeah.
these national identities on people.
And it was the victors in the First World War. There's been a lot of sentimental twaddle about the First World War, the Great War. I think it did terrific harm.
Right.
and the Second World War was because of that.
Right.
And I think that what's going on in Ukraine right now is caused by that and so forth. We could go back and back. But the fact is that the carving up of the Middle East into these countries was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
The Ottomans were not the most efficient rulers. But they rule by millet. They rule by religious community. So all the religious communities had representatives, the Roman Catholics, the Maronites, the Latin Catholics, I should say, the Maronites, the Greek Catholics, the Melkites, the Greek Orthodox, and so forth and so on, the Copts. Everyone, well, the Copts were out of Ottoman control by the beginning of the 19th century with the setting up of the Khedivate in Egypt. But the fact is that the minorities could come, but now you draw lines and then you suddenly make majorities and minorities,
right.
and the minorities have no rights.
So is the solution then, when we're rethinking these boundaries, is let's say that we actually did this. We had a kind of world congress or conference and brought all the parties together and decided to redraw the map of the Middle East. Would we have more states or fewer, do you think?
I think you might have fewer states that were with more sort of subordination at them, not everything so centered on one capital. But I would think that there's no logical distinction between Syria and Iraq
right.
and Jordan.
Right.
So there was a certainly, even Lebanon now, Lebanon after the 1920s, is much larger than the old Mutasarrafia, as they call it, the administrative district of Mount Lebanon, which was semi-independent even under the Ottomans as a Christian statelet. It was basically like a Trieste.
Right.
And then suddenly they expanded their borders. Now they're the size of Connecticut. And they've taken in a lot of, like all Connecticut is divided between Yankees fans and Boston Red Sox fans.
Well, yes, I made that mistake
they've gotten they have a much larger Muslim population than they did in the old Mutasarrafia.
Sure. Mm.
Now, as the U.S. government works to counter the Islamic State, there are still some individual Americans or Europeans who identify as Muslims who are joining it. That it's. And as you write in your article, a lot of them are not really that informed about Islam or even about the political force that they're joining. How does that affect this movement?
Those people are they get a lot of attention because we're upset when we find out that Americans
right.
and Frenchmen and so forth and so on. You'll find that all of those people were somehow people who are having a hard time psychologically fitting into their setting. And there are also
they're setting here in the United States.
In the United
yeah.
States or in France.
And you,
yeah.
I think as you also point out in the article that a number of them have read this
Islam for Dummies. Islam for Dummies. A friend of mine is a retired professor from William & Mary. Always digs up this type of information. And when the government is tracing the records of these people, they find on their bill from Barnes & Noble or from Amazon.com that they have been ordering Islam for Dummies. And many of them don't know an awful lot of the details.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the poor young man who was just killed a few days ago seems to have been a convert to Islam. But I think he hardly knew what he was getting involved in.
So how do we counter that, do you think?
I think basically we have to enter into get everybody in the area to enter into dialogue with each other and to be serious about. For instance, right now Qatar has been for a long time. Qatar has been favoring Sunni groups in Syria,
right?
And I think there are problems with that. I think everybody has to.
And that's something that the United States has not been talking a lot about, but they know it.
No. And we know very well. I mean, Saudi Arabia buys our AWACS, so we like them.
Huh? Right, right.
And they like, they're great consumers of American products.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to look really at pressure the Saudi monarchy to be proactive in this thing and to try to rein in some of their Sunni allies. But the trouble is that you can deal with the monarchy, but there's a lot of other people in Saudi Arabia. I mean, the family of Osama bin Laden, most of them can't stand him.
Right.
He has a sister who lives in Beirut,
right.
And they're horrified by everything he did. But the fact is that there has to be a greater self-restraining, self-policing by some of the Sunni states in the Middle East.
Now, is there a credible diplomatic or a dialogical effort that could be made with the so-called Islamic State? I mean, a number of people have said that's just naive, that's not something that they're going to respond to.
I don't think they are going to respond to that, because I think they are a small group of very angry people. And I think the real background is that they are the Sunni. Iraq is about 55% at least Shiite.
Mm-hmm.
It is about, was until fairly recently, about 5% Christian. And the other 40% of Iraq is basically Sunni, but half of them are Kurds and half of them are Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
So the Sunni Arabs are a minority of a minority. And that they feel when Saddam Hussein was ruling and his father the Ba'ath Party, basically, they sort of dominated.
Right.
And then they've sort of lost out, and that's going to be, I think, very difficult to overcome that anger.
And there's a way in which we have, the United States, have contributed to this problem, right, with the de-Ba'athification and the abolition of the military in the early days of the occupation of Iraq.
We must remember that the Ba'ath Party was a secular party.
Right.
The original founder, Michel Aflaq, was a Christian from Syria.
Right.
And he wasn't deeply devout, but he was a Christian from Syria. He finally had to take refuge in Iraq from Syria.
Right.
But the Arab nationalism was really what was behind all Ba'ath sort of thought.
Right.
But Arab nationalism now is so dated. It's one thinks of Nasser now and that generation as being in some other world.
Right.
Now, is there one thing that you think could really help give people context to the situation that most people miss when they try to understand what's going on?
I think what most people miss is that majority rule can lead to disenfranchisement of minorities. And in many ways, the Middle East, before it was divided up after the First World War, was a place where minorities could all be heard. They cannot be heard now, and that's that leads to a sort of tyrannical majorities or self-created majorities. For instance, trying to create an Islamic state, which of course would be a caliphate, therefore is Sunni, and that's. But that means you're going to have to take a good patch of Syria and a fair amount of Iraq and stitch them together.
And so, but in this reimagined map of the Middle East, do you see a place for the Islamic State, so-called?
I think basically Muslims will have to figure that out themselves. But I think most Muslims are horrified by this type of extremism. The type of the Islamic world is much more sophisticated than that. I think there's a lot of fakery going on with the piety of some of these leaders of the Islamic State, that suddenly, you know, the very fact that they were wearing balaclavas to disguise their faces,
right,
indicates that they just in case this doesn't work, they might be able to just blend into the crowd.
Right, Right. And how would you characterize, I mean, there, in Washington, of course, we hear people saying, what's amazing to me is that it was, you know, 12 months ago, no one had ever heard of these folks. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, they have created a country in the middle of the Middle East. And it's now, according to some in Washington, the greatest national security threat that we face. Do you agree with this assessment?
I seldom agree with what Washington under either political party has to say. I don't think Washington has been very sophisticated at all in dealing with the Middle East, with dealing with Africa. I can't say enough about Asia because I haven't spent much time in Asia, but I can tell you over the Middle East and Africa, I find our diplomats are generally bumbling.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the response then, which has basically been to try to isolate the Islamic State and bomb them.
Yeah. That's not going to work.
No.
No, because...
So what will? What will?
They'll have to send troops in on the ground, I'm afraid.
You think so?
Yeah. It's disastrous because we see what a disaster our invasion of Iraq was. But the only way they'll be able to support the... people of Erbil in those places is by going in to support them with troops on the ground. You can bomb all you want, but basically you see the aerial view. It's a lot of desertified land, and there's not great concentrations of ministries of war and things like that.
So you're dropping bombs in the sand.
Yeah, you are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, or killing innocent civilians.
Right.
Do you think a U.S.-led invasion will stir up just additional anger and additional response from the
Islamic
State?
It could, yeah. It could very much so. It shouldn't be U.S.-led. I think it should be more diversified in leadership.
How does the U.S. go about sort of pulling that coalition together?
I think somebody else should really pull it together. And I would suggest that some of the former colonial states in the area and should step up to the bat, and particularly the French and the British who created this problem. And also I think that the other thing is that the United Nations really,
right,
I think, will have to be involved.
And of course we shouldn't finish our segment here without mentioning what has happened to the Christians in these areas, which is a great tragedy.
It is terrible. The
last Christian has left Mosul after 1,800 years.
That's right. Yeah. The fact is, that's why I think the Archdiocese of Detroit has something like 16 or 18 different Catholic rites, because they have so many Christians from Iraq and Syria and that part of the world represented within the Archdiocese of Detroit. There's a huge migration out.
Right.
Many Lebanese, this is part of the problem of Lebanon. So many have migrated out over the last few decades. But also it's a problem of Syria and Iraq that there's we Jesuits used to have a secondary school from the 1930s, yes, and a college from the 50s
in Baghdad. The New England province.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And they were great success. They used to call the high school, which is called Baghdad College, they called BC on the Tigris. But the those people now are living in Canada or in the United States, and we are benefiting from their education, but it's a great pity for those countries that they have left. And that means also many of the Muslims from those countries. I mean, I've met alumni of those schools working in Nigeria and Ghana who are actually Muslims.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're trying to stay away from this place, too.
With good reason.
Yeah.
Well, you are listening to America This Week on Sirius XM, Channel 129. Our guest has been Father Patrick Ryan, who is the Lawrence McGinley Professor at Fordham University. Father Ryan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.